Chapter 50. Turning one over after another, and musing over these memorials, the unhappy man passed many hours. His dearest vanities, ambitious hopes, had all been here. What pride he had in his boy! He was the handsomest child ever seen. Everybody said he was like a nobleman's son. A royal princess had remarked him, and kissed him, and asked his name in Kew Gardens. What city man could show such another? Could a prince have been better cared for? Anything that money could buy had been his son's. He used to go down on speech days with four horses and new liveries, and scatter new shillings among the boys at the school where George was. When he went with George to the depot of his regiment, before the boy embarked for Canada, he gave the officer such a dinner as the Duke of York might have sat down to. Had he ever refused a bill when George drew one? There they were paid without a word. Many a general in the army couldn't ride the horses he had. He had the child before his eyes, on 100 different days, when he remembered George after dinner, when he used to come in as bold as a lord and drink off his glass by his father's side, at the head of the table on the pony at Brighton, when he cleared the hedge and kept up with the huntsman on the day, when he was presented to the Prince Regent at the levee, when all St. James couldn't produce a finer young fellow. And this was the end of all. To marry a bankrupt and fly in the face of duty and fortune. What humiliation and fury. What pangs of sickening rage, balked ambition and love. What wounds of outraged vanity, tenderness even, had this old worldling now to suffer under. Having examined these papers, and pondered over this one and the other, in that bitterest of all helpless woe, with which miserable men think of happy past times, George's father took the whole of the documents out of the drawer in which he had kept them so long, and locked them into a writing box, which he tied, and sealed with his seal. Then he opened the bookcase, and took down the great red Bible we have spoken of, a pompous book, seldom looked at, and shining all over with gold. There was a frontispiece to the volume, representing Abraham sacrificing Isaac. Here, according to custom, Osborne had recorded on the fly leaf, and in his large clerk-like hand, the dates of his marriage and his wife's death, and the births and Christian names of his children. Jane came first, then George Sedley Osborne, then Maria Frances, and the days of the christening of each. Taking a pen, he carefully obliterated George's names from the page, and when the leaf was quite dry, restored the volume to the place from which he had moved it. Then he took a document out of another drawer, where his own private papers were kept, and having read it, crumpled it up, and lighted it at one of the candles, and saw it burn entirely away in the grate. It was his will, which being burned, he sat down, and wrote off a letter, and rang for his servant, whom he charged to deliver it in the morning. It was morning already. As he went up to bed, the whole house was alight with the sunshine, and the birds were singing among the fresh green leaves in Russell Square. Anxious to keep all Mr. Osborne's family and dependents in good humor, and to make as many friends as possible for George in his hour of adversity, William Dobbin, who knew the effect which good dinners and good wines have upon the soul of man, wrote off immediately on his return to his inn the most hospitable of invitations to Thomas Chopper Esquire, begging that gentleman to dine with him at the Slaughters next day. The note reached Mr. Chopper before he left the city, and the instant reply was that Mr. Chopper presents his respectful compliments, and will have the honor and pleasure of waiting on Captain D. The invitation and the rough draft of the answer were shown to Mrs. Chopper and her daughters on his return to Somers Town that evening, and they talked about military gents and West End men with great exultation as the family sat and partook of tea. When the girls had gone to rest, Mr. and Mrs. C. discoursed upon the strange events which were occurring in the governor's family. Never had the clerk seen his principal so moved. When he went in to Mr. Osborne, after Captain Dobbin's departure, Mr. Chopper found his chief black in the face, and all but in a fit. Some dreadful quarrel, he was certain, had occurred between Mr. O. and the young captain. Chopper had been instructed to make out an account of all sums paid to Captain Osborne within the last 3 years. And a precious lot of money he has had to, the chief clerk said, and respected his old and young master the more, for the liberal way in which the guineas had been flung about. The dispute was something about Miss Sedley. Mrs. Chopper vowed and declared she pitied that poor young lady, to lose such a handsome young fellow as the captain. As the daughter of an unlucky speculator, who had paid a very shabby dividend, Mr. Chopper had no great regard for Miss Sedley. He respected the house of Osborne before all others in the city of London. And his hope and wish was that Captain George should marry a nobleman's daughter. The clerk slept a great deal sounder than his principal that night, and, cuddling his children after breakfast, of which he partook with a very hearty appetite, though his modest cup of life was only sweetened with brown sugar, he set off in his best Sunday suit and frilled shirt for business, promising his admiring wife not to punish Captain D'Apostrophe's port too severely that evening. Mr. Osborne's countenance, when he arrived in the city at his usual time, struck those dependents who were accustomed, for good reasons, to watch its expression, as peculiarly ghastly and worn. At 12 o'clock, Mr. Hicks, of the firm of Hicks and Blatherwick, solicitors, Bedford Row, called by appointment, and was ushered into the governor's private room, and closeted it there for more than an hour. At about 1, Mr. Chopper received a note brought by Captain Dobbin's man, and containing an enclosure for Mr. Osborne, which the clerk went in and delivered. A short time afterwards, Mr. Chopper and Mr. Birch, the next clerk, were summoned, and requested to witness a paper. "I've been making a new will," Mr. Osborne said, "to which these gentlemen appended their names accordingly." No conversation passed. Mr. Hicks looked exceedingly grave as he came into the outer rooms, and very hard in Mr. Chopper's face, but there were not any explanations. It was remarked that Mr. Osborne was particularly quiet and gentle all day, to the surprise of those who had augured ill from his darkling demeanor. He called no man names that day, and was not heard to swear once. He left business early, and before going away, summoned his chief clerk once more, and having given him general instructions, asked him, after some seeming hesitation and reluctance to speak, if he knew whether Captain Dobbin was in town. Chopper said he believed he was. Indeed, both of them knew the fact perfectly. Osborne took a letter directed to that officer, and giving it to the clerk, requested the latter to deliver it into Dobbin's own hands immediately. "And now, Chopper," says he, taking his hat, and with a strange look, "my mind will be easy." Exactly as the clock struck 2, there was no doubt an appointment between the pair. Mr. Frederick Bullock called, and he and Mr. Osborne walked away together. The colonel of the TH regiment, in which Messrs. Dobbin and Osborne had companies, was an old general who had made his first campaign under Wolfe at Quebec, and was long since quite too old and feeble for command, but he took some interest in the regiment, of which he was the nominal head, and made certain of his young officers welcome at his table, a kind of hospitality which I believe is not now common amongst his brethren. Captain Dobbin was an especial favorite of this old general. Dobbin was versed in the literature of his profession, and could talk about the great Frederick, and the Empress Queen, and their wars, almost as well as the general himself, who was indifferent to the triumphs of the present day, and whose heart was with the tacticians of 50 years back. This officer sent a summons to Dobbin to come and breakfast with him on the morning when Mr. Osborne altered his will and Mr. Chopper put on his best shirt frill, and then informed his young favorite, a couple of days in advance, of that which they were all expecting, a marching order to go to Belgium. The order for the regiment to hold itself in readiness would leave the horse guards in a day or two, and as transports were in plenty, they would get their route before the week was over. Recruits had come in during the stay of the regiment at Chatham, and the old general hoped that the regiment which had helped to beat Montcalm in Canada and to rout Mr. Washington on Long Island would prove itself worthy of its historical reputation on the oft-trodden battlegrounds of the Low Countries. And so, my good friend, if you have any affair law, said the old general, taking a pinch of snuff with his trembling white old hand, and then pointing to the spot of his robe, the chamber under which his heart was still feebly beating, if you have any Phyllis to console, or to bid farewell to Papa and Mama, or any will to make, I recommend you to set about your business without delay. With which the general gave his young friend a finger to shake, and a good-natured nod of his powdered and pig-tailed head, and the door being closed upon Dobbin, sate down to pen a poulet. He was exceedingly vain of his French, to Mademoiselle Aminade of His Majesty's Theatre. This news made Dobbin grave, and he thought of our friends at Brighton, and then he was ashamed of himself that Amelia was always the first thing in his thoughts, always, before anybody, before father and mother, sisters and duty, always at waking and sleeping indeed, and all day long. And returning to his hotel, he sent off a brief note to Mr. Osborne acquainting him with the information which he had received, and which might tend farther, he hoped, to bring about a reconciliation with George. This note, dispatched by the same messenger who had carried the invitation to Chopper on the previous day, alarmed the worthy clerk not a little. It was enclosed to him, and as he opened the letter he trembled lest the dinner should be put off on which he was calculating. His mind was inexpressibly relieved when he found that the envelope was only a reminder for himself. "Shall expect you at 5:30. Captain Dobbin wrote. He was very much interested about his employer's family, but, cave all his vows, a grand dinner was of more concern to him than the affairs of any other mortal. Dobbin was quite justified in repeating the general's information to any officers of the regiment whom he should see in the course of his peregrinations. Accordingly he imparted it to Ensign Stubble, whom he met at the agent's, and who, such was his military ardor, went off instantly to purchase a new sword at the accoutrement maker's. Here this young fellow, who, though only 17 years of age, and about 65 inches high, with a constitution naturally rickety and much impaired by premature brandy and water, had an undoubted courage and a lion's heart, poised, tried, bent, and balanced a weapon such as he thought would do execution amongst Frenchmen. Shouting a ha, and stamping his little feet with tremendous energy, he delivered the point twice or thrice at Captain Dobbin, who parried the thrust laughingly with his bamboo walking stick. Mr. Stubble, as may be supposed from his size and slenderness, was of the light bobs. Ensign Spoony, on the contrary, was a tall youth, and belonged to Captain Dobbin's, the Grenadier Company, and he tried on a new bearskin cap, under which he looked savage beyond his years. Then these two lads went off to the slaughters, and having ordered a famous dinner, sate down and wrote off letters to the kind anxious parents at home, letters full of love and heartiness, and pluck and bad spelling. Ah! There were many anxious hearts beating through England at that time, and mother's prayers and tears flowing in many homesteads. Seeing young Stubble engaged in composition at one of the coffee room tables at the slaughters, and the tears trickling down his nose onto the paper, for the youngster was thinking of his mama, and that he might never see her again, Dobbin, who was going to write off a letter to George Osborne, relented, and locked up his desk. "Why should I?" said he. "Better have this night happy. I'll go and see my parents early in the morning, and go down to Brighton myself tomorrow." So he went up, and laid his big hand on young Stubble's shoulder, and backed up that young champion, and told him, if he would leave off brandy and water he would be a good soldier, as he always was a gentlemanly good-hearted fellow. Young Stubble's eyes brightened up at this, for Dobbin was greatly respected in the regiment, as the best officer and the cleverest man in it. "Thank you, Dobbin," he said, rubbing his eyes with his knuckles, "I was just telling her I would. And, oh sir, she's so damn kind to me. The water pumps were at work again, and I am not sure that the soft-hearted captain's eyes did not also twinkle. The two ensigns, the captain, and Mr. Chopper, dined together in the same box. Chopper brought the letter from Mr. Osborne, in which the latter briefly presented his compliments to Captain Dobbin, and requested him to forward the enclosed to Captain George Osborne. Chopper knew nothing further. He described Mr. Osborne's appearance, it is true, and his interview with his lawyer, wondered how the governor had sworn at nobody, and especially as the wine circled round abounded in speculations and conjectures. But these grew more vague with every glass, and at length became perfectly unintelligible. At a late hour Captain Dobbin put his guest into a hackney coach, in a hiccuping state, and swearing that he would be the kick captain's friend forever and ever. When Captain Dobbin took leave of Miss Osborne we have said, that he asked leave, to come and pay her another visit, and the spinster expected him for some hours the next day, when, perhaps, had he come, and had he asked her that question which she was prepared to answer, she would have declared herself as her brother's friend, and a reconciliation might have been effected between George and his angry father. But though she waited at home the captain never came. He had his own affairs to pursue, his own parents to visit and console, and at an early hour of the day, to take his place on the Lightning coach, and go down to his friends at Brighton. In the course of the day Miss Osborne heard her father give orders, that that meddling scoundrel, Captain Dobbin, should never be admitted within his doors again, and any hopes in which she may have indulged privately were thus abruptly brought to an end. Mr. Frederick Bullock came, and was particularly affectionate to Maria, and attentive to the broken-spirited old gentleman. For though he said his mind would be easy, the means which he had taken to secure quiet did not seem to have succeeded as yet, and the events of the past 2 days had visibly shattered him. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.